hello and welcome to something I just planned here on the fly. We're doing a Keeneland Saturday special because we've got three segments. They're all related to Keeneland, and we're just going to put them in one show, and it's going to kick off right now. A special guest for a special segment as we double up, actually really are going to end up tripling up on Keeneland coverage for this Saturday on the Players Podcast. Man who's never been on the show somehow, been elsewhere on the network, but not on the Players Show. Very excited to welcome to these airwaves the director of Keeneland Sales Operations, Cormac Brannock. Cormac, how are things?
Things are great, Pete. Things are great. Thanks for having me on. It's exciting to finally be on your flagship show.
There you go. Well, I wanted to ask you so far for just a little bit of how the meet has gone, a little bit of an update from your point of view. You know, we've been following things from a gambling point of view. We've talked about the terrific numbers on the reduced takeout double, the tremendous success of the grade one gamble once again. But we haven't talked about it as much like macro level in terms of what we've seen from a racing perspective. How's it been so far for you guys?
It's been really great. We're very fortunate here at Keeneland. We have a huge audience of people who want to participate every spring and fall. And, you know, it's our job and our role to try to maximize that and give as many people the best experience they can have and keep them coming back. And so we've had big crowds. We got a little bit, you know, the weather was Kentucky spring weather in that second week, but it's an outdoor sport. What can you do? And we still had good crowds, good handle, and touch wood, great and safe racing. So we've 10 days down, 6 cards to go, including today. You know, a lot of full fields, and it's, you know, we have the construction project going on. We're trying to expand to accommodate more patrons. We'll have by the fall of next year the paddock building in place, and about 1,400 plus public dining seats, new ticketing options available. So hopefully we'll go from selling out in minutes to maybe selling out in 15 minutes, but it's really been another great spring meet, and we're looking forward to the next 6 days.
I had the construction project on my list of things to ask you about a little bit later. Going to make you look at some form with us here for Saturday.
Sure.
In terms of these interesting races on the later part of the card. But how would you describe what's going to happen with that sort of paddock expansion? I mean, sort of famously, you're in a little bit tight there right now in the current configuration. I assume alleviating some of that pressure around the parade ring is part of it, but it sounds like there's a hospitality element as well.
There is. It'll really serve a lot of purposes. You know, first off, to get more fans in the gates and give them a really elevated option to watch racing and try to increase the fan base for the sport as much as we possibly can. It'll also, because of, you know, new kitchen areas and a lot of new dining spaces, we'll have a lot of options that will transfer into my side of it as well, which is the sales side. So we're the paddock building is adjacent to the sales pavilion, so that'll give our sales customers some more dining options as well. So it'll be a space that we can use for many reasons year round. But then, you know, the viewing into the paddock from that side was very popular when this was done on a temporary basis for a couple of the Breeders' Cups we've held. That's sort of what kind of was the seed towards doing this permanent expansion. So we're really excited about it. The goal is that this will it'll look like it's always been there. You know, it's Keeneland's an iconic place. We're not trying to change so much as we're trying to modernize, move with the times, and increase our facilities for the demand that we're lucky to have. And we'll be looking forward to unveiling it in a little over a year.
We're going to talk about this more on another show in the near future. I have a project cooking where I want to sort of talk about what the racetrack should really be aiming to look like come the middle of this century, and the fact that so many of the key players are thinking ahead. I think there's an interesting show to get out of it. But I want to dive in to one of the things that makes Keeneland unique in USA racing terms, especially the combination of being a sales company and a racetrack. Obviously, that affords you some real advantages in terms of finances, I would imagine. And that I'm just very interested in that cross-pollination. And I know you have a sale coming up at the end of this week that I would imagine is carefully timed to be with the end of the Keeneland racing season. How much does the sales side at Keeneland and the racing side at Keeneland interact, and how would you sort of describe the relationship in very broad strokes?
It's a great question, and I think we interact very closely with one another. It's sort of the left hand and right hand. We're all working towards the same mission, which is to further the sport and to grow it. And in our revenue that we generate, a lot of which is through the sales arena, goes straight back into the industry, whether it's to fund the purse structure or to work on industry advancement initiatives, be that drug testing, research into equine safety and equine health, and so forth. And we work very closely together. So Gatewood Bell is our vice president of sales, and a lot of your listeners will know him, but he's sure done everything in the industry, from bloodstock agent to syndicate owner manager to now being VP of sales here. We talk all the time about how our racing customers and our sales customers there's about 90% overlap. Most of the people that are in one side of the industry are in the other as well. So one of our real focuses is to accommodate those people. We want them to come back to our sales, but we also want them to enjoy the race day experience as much as possible. So that's where we all get to celebrate the hard work that goes into the sales side, is watching the horses compete on the track. So that's something we work very closely with hand in hand.
I want to ask about the sale specifically that's coming up, and we'll have a lot of listeners who will be around. Is that something that's going to be open to the public that they can check out? I mean, especially those with interest in eventually getting in on that side of the business?
It certainly is. This is the second time we've held this sale at the end of the closing race days card. We did this 2 years ago for the first time. It was really well received. It kind of allows us to celebrate the close, but also the beginning of what becomes Derby Week. And, with the proximity of the sales pavilion to the racetrack, it's a short walk to close out your race day and come down at the pavilion. And we'll have Grey Goose sponsorship and past cocktails. And we'll have sandwiches from Drake's, a local restaurant. We're going to have live music to kick off that event. And then for an hour afterwards, after the sale ends, which should be roughly 9 p.m., let's say. So between 9 and 10 p.m. So it's kind of a little party event. We've 125 horses cataloged in the sale, all race horses, not all of whom have raced, but they're all three and up, and horses that are with current form or hopefully ready to run. So it's a way to gain entry for people who are interested in the sport, maybe leave the racetrack and at least get their feet wet or get some experience in the sales arena after that, and try to get more new people in the game.
Horses, a racing age sale definitely affords an opportunity to have less patience, I would imagine, than a yearling sale, certainly. And it's an interesting, I was looking through the catalog, it was very, very an interesting mix of horses, to say the least. I'm curious to see, I would assume you're looking to build on the success of the sale 2 years ago. And is it a sale that people can watch? Is there going to be any coverage of it as well?
Yes, it'll be live streamed on the website, like all our sales are. So it's an easy sale to interact with, either as a fan or as an investor through a login. There'll be a lot of online bidding, and we have a lot of international interest in American thoroughbreds, which is great for the industry here, and some emerging markets in the Middle East in particular that have dirt racing that have done very well with horses bought out of this sale and others. So the digital component and the online participation is a big part of this.
What's the best way for people with questions about getting involved in horse ownership or interested, maybe somebody who's been going to Keeneland for years and interested to learn more on the sales side? Obviously, there's other players, bloodstock agents, things like that you'll need to be hooked on with. But I imagine you guys provide some information as well to interested parties.
We do, and we have a staff of the switchboard that directs calls at these to people like me or some other members of the sales team. So we're always trying to give people the guidance that they need. This is it's the most exciting industry and sport in the world, but it's also, there's a learning curve and it can be intimidating to some. So we're always here ready to try to let people in and give them some guidance how to get started.
You mentioned Gatewood Bell before. One thing I love about talking to so many of the Keeneland folks, whether it's you or Gatewood or Jim Goodman is you're people who play the races and read the form and are very active in the game. You know, it used to be from the stories I've heard about, you know, many moons ago, the divide between industry people and players was pretty darn wide. And I love to see all the cross-pollination that happens now. With that in mind, I did want to ask you to chat about some of these races we have on the card on Saturday at Keeneland, if you're still game for that.
Sure, happy to.
Excellent. Where shall we begin? Maybe some of the stakes action, the Elkhorn?
Sure, yeah. This will be a really strong close to the card on Saturday. And the Elkhorn looks like a very deep, very, very deep race. The last two winners of the Sycamore, which is the mile and a half equivalent turf race in the fall, are back here. One of them being Bold Act, who's coming out of a big win in Dubai. And then there are several other, you know, horses coming off layoffs and a horse on the outside, like Silver Knot, another Godolphin. Shipper, who was just touched off here in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf two Novembers ago. So it looks like a really competitive field.
Yeah, for me, I wanted to play the pace angle in here. It looked like there was plenty of speed signed on. You know, longer priced horses, but sometimes, you know, if you're a long shot, it's like all the more reason to contribute to early pace. I thought it might really play into the hands of Bold Act, who's just shown so much class and had that big run, as you mentioned, in the Sycamore, relishes this distance. And obviously, Charlie Appleby at this point, Frankie Dettori, need no introduction to USA Racing fans. Who do you see as the main danger to him?
I agree that he's the one to beat, and you know, for a lot of the multi-race wagers, might be worth playing as a single. But you know, the seven horse Christoph has a shipper coming over from Germany, who has good form. You know, is going to love the trip. Has Tyler in the irons. You know, Christoph just is somebody you can never rule out, and his horses usually run very well off the shelf and just first time over here in the States. Highland Chief, obviously, you know, if he can return to his form, he's coming off a very long layoff, but with one of the best trainers in the game in Graham Motion, his horses, he hasn't won a race here at the meet yet, but they all seem to be running really well. You know, I don't think it'd be too big of a surprise if his old class shows him right at the head of proceedings. And then maybe for a price play, Foreign Relations, you know, Connor Murphy is a very skilled cannon on board, so he may be one to keep on side underneath.
A lot of good ideas there. Winning Spirit, that Clement first time starter. Yeah, I wasn't too sure. You know, I often that Italian form doesn't hold up, but Germany is another story. If you're able to win, you know, even at the listed level there, wouldn't surprise me if you could beat, you know, a lot of USA based turf horses based on the strength of that international form. We'll see if any of them are good enough to stand up to Bold Act in this year's Elkhorn. Let's move on to the Ben Ali Stakes. This is a race I talked about a bunch on the Friday show, Cormac, because we had Larry Roman on, who's the owner of Laughing sure. Boy. He and I were both very intimidated by Kings Barnes in this spot, who had that prep race at Gulfstream and on these beautiful bloodlines.
That is pretty well basically how I saw it too. I mean, I think
stretching out
he was
today.
Very impressive coming off the layoff and shortening up to 7 furlongs. He got a good setup, got a lot of pace to run at. But I'd imagine he'll go to the lead here. And if Laughing Boy doesn't push him too hard, I don't know if Larry Roman gave that away or not. But if Kings Barnes gets it his own way, I think he'll be very tough to run down. I think the class of the race outside of Kings Barnes would be Smile Happy if there is a bit of a speed duel up front. He's been gelded. Be interesting to see him if he can run his best race. He's going to be a tough foe as well. And actually, he's in our sale on closing day on Friday the 26th, as is Dynamic One, who's an old class horse coming out of this race as well. So, you know, Dynamic One's going to need a big pace setup, but that extra sort of 16th of a mile, that mile and 3/16ths, will help him with the pretty long stretch. So I think Kings Barnes is the one to beat. But like I said, if he's pressed on the lead, Smile Happy could be right there, and Dynamic One should be doing his best running late.
Larry indicated they'll be sending with Laughing Boy. I wonder if Kings Barnes will just try to sit off. He has stalked and pounced effectively. But boy, if it does set up the possibility of a duel, either of those horses entered in the sale on Friday could start to look very interesting, at least for underneath of a runner like King's Barnes in terms of Smile Happy or Dynamic One. Here's a left field question for you that I didn't prep you for, but I get asked this all the time when I'm doing the Sky Sports stateside coverage of American racing over there. You mentioned about Smile Happy getting gelded at age five. I'm asked once a month, I'll say, why it is that so many U.S.-based horses are left entire, i.e. not gelded, compared to their brethren who run in the U.K. and Ireland. Do you have any answer to that, why there aren't more geldings in these older horses of racing age who don't look like they're going to have, you know, stallion careers necessarily?
You know, I don't really. I've kind of wondered the same thing myself. I think, you know, we don't have races here in the States that are restricted to entires like the Derby and some of the races back in Europe. So there's really not a lot of reason to keep colts intact unless, you know, they're really showing that kind of ability. I think a lot of horses are just left as they are unless they really show signs of wanting that equipment change. But right. it's a tricky one to answer. I think a lot of people just want to leave them intact if they can get away with it.
Right. Just why have a surgery if you don't need to?
Sure.
I guess. I mean, there's a logic to that. If you're well behaved enough. I mean, is it right? Accurate to say that gelding isn't necessarily, I mean, let me ask, I don't really know. I mean, I think when I get asked that question, I almost get the sense that people in that part of the world sometimes think of gelding as a potentially performance enhancing operation. I always thought it was more of a mental thing to, I mean, let's face it, limit distractions, as opposed to anything. I do know it can change a horse physically. What's your, and I apologize for taking you down this unprepared rabbit hole, but what in your experience with racehorses do you see as the difference, like just in physical terms?
Yeah, I think that the two biggest things are body mass. You know, horses that might be just getting too heavy for their frame or too heavy for their athletic peak. I think that's where probably most of the gelding occurs. And you'll see in some pedigrees, some sires are more likely to throw that sort of bigger framed, heavier individual and more likely then to have their male horses gelded during the racing careers. And then the second reason would be focus. And if people just think they're not, you know, finishing out their races, or like you said, have too many distractions, that might be the second option, but the second reason. But, you know, a lot of horses have been improved by gelding, and sometimes it doesn't make any difference, but it's a last resort.
You've given me some good stuff to use the next time I get asked these questions. So thank you. I didn't realize this was going to be a personal research project today as much as a chat about Keeneland Saturday. One more race on the Keeneland card on Saturday after those two big graded stakes. And it's an interesting 5.5 furlong turf sprint for fillies and mares. I was curious if you had any thoughts on this one.
I was drawn to Definite Diva, five horse in this race. Just noticed, Kelly Breen is bringing this filly in. He came in yesterday with his first runner in a while here at Keeneland and won a dirt sprint. I think the horse was called the Distractor or something like that.
Right.
He was here himself, and now I notice he's got Arad Ortiz up in the irons. This horse is coming out of three turf sprints at Gulfstream. Looks to be improving. She won pretty well. It's hard to win these races by multiple lengths, by open lengths, and she won by two last time. Seems to be going the right way, and her damn pretty perfection was a very good turf sprinter. So I just thought this horse, 8-1 morning line, looked a little interesting for Terry Birch and Jim Stone, Stoneway Farm. So thought that might be one, if she's anything like 8-1 at post time, could be worth a look. But then I noticed the first AE is an obvious kind of horse with Steve Asmussen and Arad is booked there as well. So if that horse draws in and Arad jumps ship, that might change strategy a little bit.
We'll check the scratches and see, but that's a good shout. Good, very good case on Definite Diva. Kelly Breen, one of the few people in racing with a better hat collection than me. And good to see him having success out there at Keeneland. I was a little,
that's how he introduces himself, Pete.
I was a little more intrigued by the favorite, a little boring in here compared to you. I did think Proud Mary with some very interesting bloodlines and some good runs.
Sure.
Was another one to maybe keep in the mix there. Did you give her much count in this spot?
Yeah, that's certainly a filly that could has a winner's chance in here. So, you know, there's nothing definite about the five horse, but I thought maybe more of a sneaky play. But yeah, Proud Mary looks like she could be certainly good enough to win. And Jonathan Thomas's horses are in good form, and you get Frankie on board. So what's not to like there?
Cormac, great stuff. Really appreciate you coming on the show. We'll have you back very soon.
Look forward to it. Thank you, Pete.
America's Day at the Races returns this Saturday on Fox Sports to cover the Aqueduct Spring Meet. Tune in this Saturday to watch 9 exhilarating races headlined by the return of turf racing in the Dangerous Hour Stakes. Join JK, Maggie Wolfendale, Acacia, and the rest of the Fox team for live racing, expert analysis, expert picks, and more. Bet on the races using Naira Bets. New members receive up to a $200 deposit match and a $25 free bet. It's nonstop fun at the Aqueduct Spring Meet. For showtimes and a full TV schedule, go to inthemoneypodcast.com/TV. Next up on the show, a little more analysis of the Saturday card at Keeneland. We're going to bring in the man who makes the morning line over there. He's a regular on these airwaves. He's Nick Tamaro. Nick, how are things?
I'm doing well, Pete. Thank you. I'm probably not that willing for you to admit that I make the morning line, but hey, it's public knowledge.
Have you had some frustrations lately? Is that what you're telling me?
I mean, look, it's a very difficult endeavor, right? Predicting what the public's going to do a week in advance. I've certainly gotten some negative feedback, some rather colorful comments from certain people, but nothing that I couldn't handle. So onward and upward.
You can always use the thing about people who want to get in like Twitter fights. Now, granted, now that Twitter allows you to write novels, I guess they can theoretically have their say. But JK and I used to always enjoy the fact that they could send their dumb tweet and then we could come on here and, you know, actually, you know, make cases as to why what they were saying was completely wrong. You're welcome to do that if you want, if you need the therapy at any point. But I'm also happy to just dive right into the race.
Yeah, I don't really think it's worth the oxygen.
Fair enough. Let's talk about the pick five at Keeneland on Saturday, starting with race number 6, where we've got an allowance race for fillies and mares going a mile on a turf and a big full field signed on. Some interesting runners in here, an old friend in Sacred Wish. You got some interesting first-time USA types. Very curious to hear what you think about this one from a horse-playing standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, the race sort of goes through Sacred Wish, right? She's very much the horse to beat. She is off a layoff, which isn't the greatest thing, but her form, especially towards the end of 2023, was very strong. And she ran credibly locally as well with a fourth place finish in the Valley View, where she really kind of made one of the more meaningful moves on the outside that day. It was otherwise kind of an inside-dominated race. So I'd say she's very much the horse to beat. I think there are alternatives, you know, in making the line for this race. The horses that obviously were difficult to gauge in terms of how much the public was going to back them were the 8 and the 12 with their European running lines. And, you know, neither of them looked particularly formidable. But I will say that Olivia Miralda on the outside does look like she's definitely faced some better horses. And she feels like the one that maybe was having some issues that Lasix could assist. So I wanted to at least bring that, you know, into the mix in a way. So she's probably, if she's just drawn poorly, you know, that's the concern. I would guess that if she could show a little bit of speed, it'll help. You know, there's not a lot of pace in here, despite it being a big field. So I would say, you know, I'm inclined to really kind of take Sacred Wish and get a little bold with her, because I just think there aren't that many palatable alternatives.
We're similar. I mean, I do think she is the one that I want as my top pick in this spot. I think things should trip out for her and feels like maybe she's found a new home on the turf. I do feel like the best bits of form from Olivia Miralda put her there. Maybe it's the case where the outside draw is reflected by the betting public and you get a halfway decent price. Maybe Pratt can work something out from out there, especially if there's some tactical speed to get position. The only other one that I listed in my numbers, I had the 10 as a lone A, and then I had the 12 and the 7 listed as backups. I really like that last run from American Retro and having that prep and potentially being able to, from that middle draw, get good attacking position and move up in the second race of the season. I thought she was pretty obvious to throw in there as well at what could be a decent price. I think your guess is pretty good about the 10-1 morning line, but just, you know, obvious, I feel like, from a pace point of view in a race that doesn't have a ton of it. So we're going to call it 10-12-7. Any others you want me to name check, number check beyond the 10 and the 12 for the
notes? Yeah, I mean, I think the one Freitas the Red is worth mentioning just because she's run some races, I think, that would make her very competitive in here. So she draws well on the inside also to save some ground. And I would say you'd have to at least keep her in the mix also.
Let's talk about race number 7. We've got 3-year-old maidens, fillies. We're going 7 furlongs on the dirt in this spot. The 4-runner, She's Wicked Smart, had that very impressive, I thought, all things considered, debut at Saratoga, contesting that hot pace, going down late, but certainly showed plenty of talent in there. And that race has produced 4 next out winners. That figure fits kind of on its own in here, adjusted in the time form scale, especially, and with figure improvement for age, could be very tough. Looks to have the speed to make her own trip as well. I didn't want to completely leave out the 8-runner Sarir, a speedy looking ward with those very fast workouts. Maybe they've figured out what caused her to stop to a walk the last day at Aqueduct. I was wondering if you could keep this as simple as the 4 and the 8. And do you like those? And are there any other numbers you'd want to bring into it?
Yeah, I mean, it feels that way, right? It feels like the only other alternatives are horses that don't really light your fire. And I mean, I know that Soundbite, the 3, is a horse that went for pretty serious money at the OBS sale in April. I don't think that anybody should really discount when Brad uses Axel Concepcion. I should know this already, but I think his son is Axel Concepcion's agent.
Okay. So,
yeah, you know, that he's won a couple of races with him at Keeneland already. This is a horse who obviously is trained well. He's partially owned by Ten Strike, and a horse that you could see improving. I guess Lightning Bolt could run a little bit better second time out, but she's going to have to improve quite a bit. And I thought Sarir was tough from a morning line perspective because these Wesley Ward horses are getting absolutely pounded.
Yeah.
And she took a ton of money in her first 2 starts. So you'd have to think she's going to get a lot of money again. I would say that She's Wicked Smart, even off the layoff, is a horse that you want to focus on as well. And I guess we're supposed to be saying She's Wicked Smart, right?
That's yeah.
More appropriate pronunciation.
Very good Boston accent. I like that. I'm surprised they didn't throw the H in there on the name of She's Wicked Smart. How would you grade? You mentioned 4. How would you grade them into A's and B's here? Or is it more of a spread and survive?
Yeah, I'd probably just go 3, 4, 8 and try and get out of it, you know, back up a little bit with the 1 and 6.
All right. I like the sound of that in race number 7. Let's pivot to the 8th race. This is one we talked about a little bit earlier in the show with Cormac. Grade 2 Elkhorn, a race where I'm pretty darn boring, in my opinion. I feel like Bold Act holds the cards in here. Should be plenty of pace to set up this late run. Has the best form and figures. Has the win over the course. Can anybody beat Bold Act in the Elkhorn?
Feels like it's going to be tough, right? I mean, I made him 3-2 on the morning line just with the amount of money the Charlie Appleby horses have taken at this meet, and even especially so English Rose and last week's Jenny Wiley. I don't know how much her short price, what contributed to that was the 1-2 finish from his two horses in the Maker's Mark Mile. But Bold Act with local form and having won last time out in Dubai, he feels like a horse who's going to take a lot of beating in here. And you know, as long as Frankie can get him into a comfortable position early and let him settle and make that one run, he figures to be pretty darn tough. And it just, you know, the horses that were alternatives, Pete, they all have knocks, right? I mean, there's all something that you're a little skeptical of. Like Miss the Cut has probably been running against weaker horses, even though he runs buyer figures that would make him competitive. And Silver Knot looks like he probably wants to go shorter. Highland Chief is coming back off a monster layoff. So it just feels like a situation where Bold Act really stands out. I'd make him a lone A, and I probably have one backup ticket with a stranger like Winning Spirit, who maybe can come back over from Germany, where he did run in some good races overseas. Granted, you're not getting the caliber of Group 2 competition in Italy or Germany that you are elsewhere, but this horse didn't run badly in those races. And obviously, Christoph Clement's a guy who can have a horse ready off this kind of layoff.
Yeah, Cormac gave a nice shout to Winning Spirit as well. And I do think that while I don't take Italian form super seriously, no offense to our ancestors, the German form can translate a lot better. So the fact that he was able to succeed there could be a pointer. That's probably not a bad idea to keep on side in a combo or two. I'll stand alone with the 4. Loan A 4, Loan B 7 for Nick. Ben Ali Stakes next up. We've talked about this race ad nauseum on the network. We had Larry Roman on talking about Laughing Boy. It really feels, though, like this is going to shape up absolutely beautifully for Kingsborns. Do you have any clever opinion beyond him in this spot?
I wish I did, and I kind of held my nose making him the favorite, right? I've just never been a fan of this horse. But he felt like the one the public would most readily embrace. And I saw there was something written in the DRF about a war campaign, and it was written by one of the most inveterate critics of the Morning Line, who's definitely on my shit list, put it perfectly bluntly.
And, another man with a beard and a hat? Is that who we're talking
about? Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. A guy that's a real credit to the game. So I guess war campaign's going to take a little bit of money. I actually prefer Time for Trouble of the two of them. They both run well locally, but I think Time for Trouble will be a better price. The problem with Time for Trouble is he's a rail rat. Now, the good thing is he drew the rail, right? So he's probably never going to leave the rail. The only issue that comes up for him is if the inside's bad. I don't really think that's been the case more often than not at Keeneland. You know, modern riders generally have a tendency to go two or three paths off the rail. So I think that's probably more of what contributes to it. So I kind of wanted him as the alternative. I'll use King's Barnes. I'll use War Campaign. I don't know what to make of Smile Happy. You know, I made Smile Happy a short price on the morning line because he's showing up as a new gelding off a layoff. He's run two of his best career races at Keeneland. So he just felt like a horse to me. He's also a horse who's run well fresh. He's not really run that great, at least of late, not since the Ali Sheba without Lasix. So I didn't know what to make of him. I just felt like he was a horse that was going to take some money here because of his name. And I don't know who's betting on him.
One other interesting piece of info, which I did not know until we talked to Cormac in that other segment, is that he is entered in the sale on Friday. So you figure he's got to be doing well, right? If you're looking to sell him, he's going to have to acquit himself at least okay in this spot, you'd think. I feel like if you're on the fence about him, you probably want to put him in. But I just can't see beyond Kingsborns. And it comes down to trip as much as anything else. I mean, Laughing Boy is going to, I would assume, give him a beautiful lead into the race. I guess it's possible that they duel and then it brings in all these other horses that you're mentioning. But for simplicity's sake, rather than getting wild in this spot, I think I'm going to stick to the Kingsborns idea. What are you thinking in terms of how you grade these out, the four runners you mentioned, 4, 9, 1, and 3?
I mean, I use the 1, 4, 9 equally. I back up with the 3. I don't really have anybody clever at a price. I wish I did, but that's more or less how I'd approach it.
I'm not going to ignore Laughing Boy, especially for verticals, just because I suppose there's a world in, now Sias is aggressive, so this could easily go wrong, but there's a world in which they just gun on him and Sias is just very comfortable tracking, thinking he can take him on the turn when he wants. And then, you know, if it's a speed day, why can't Laughing Boy get brave? And if it's not a speed day, I could definitely see him hanging around for second or third if Kingsborns waits to attack him. Could you see Laughing Boy hitting the money in any scenario here?
Yeah, I think that's a fair argument. I think it's more often than not a day where speed is good on the main track at Keeneland. So it's not as if the track profile will work against him at all. And he feels like a horse that you know, offers something at least a little interesting. David Jacobson's barn was red hot when he, you know, won that race. And I'm making the air quotes.
Larry would even admit that the air quotes might be valid there.
That was a pretty shitty DQ in my opinion, but whatever, you know, I wasn't involved. So I, you know, and Larry Roman's a friend of the network. So, hey, rock on.
Yeah. Even Larry said he's generally not a fan of the DQ in that situation, but you know, he wasn't complaining about his Excelsior win and his ticket being punched to Keeneland in the process. One more race to talk about in this segment. It's our nightcap, 5.5 furlongs on the turf, fillies and mares in the allowance ranks. All sort of recap what we said in the other segment, which is that I thought that it shook up really nicely for Proud Mary to get a perfect trip in this spot. I respect her immensely as the favorite. Very clever case from Cormac for number 5, Definite Diva for Kelly Breen. Wasn't sure which of these two runners, the 5 or the 13, Errat Ortiz Jr. had first call on. That would be an interesting piece of information that I probably should have dug for before the show. But anyway, he convinced me to throw in the 5. So that's where I sit at the moment, 2 and 5 in the nightcap. Very curious to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, Proud Mary is a horse to beat on paper. There's no question in my opinion. Golden Dagger should get a good trip from the inside as well. Should be able to save some ground. I may have made her a touch short on the morning line, especially because some of these Will Walden horses are really taking money. So the 7 could come down a little bit off that 5. Definite Diva's a little slow on paper. Doesn't look like she's getting the best of setups with a good bit of speed signed on in here. But I think it's a spot where Proud Mary is supposed to win. Again, as you alluded to, if Makeup gets in off the AE list, this changes substantially because you have the rider situation, but you also have another pace horse in there. And yeah, this thing can get really fast. That also, again, feels like it really works to the benefit of a horse like Proud Mary. The turf sprints have been a little bit more open in terms of results that might have surprised relative to the expectation. I think my long shot horse is the 4 Empires Princess, who might be a little bit of a price. And she might not be much more than a placing chance, but she at least showed some life last time out. And I can see her picking up some relatively serious pieces late in here.
I'll throw in one other price looking back at my original note. I'll be honest with you, I don't exactly remember what it was I noticed about the 11. All I Want Is You. But I did have this horse in my notes. And looking back, makes sense as a horse that ran some pretty darn good Timeform U.S. pace figures last year. Should be in a good attacking position. 2nd off the layoff, getting back to the right surface. That's what's bound to be a price. I'll throw that one in as well for consideration. Just 2 and 4 for you is what I wrote down to close things out here? Or did you want to mention the 13 in case Makeup gets in?
I'm going to use the 2 and 4. Yeah. I'll back up with the 1 and 13. Irad, by the way, first call is on the 5. So he'd stay on the 5
if
13 gets in.
That's a nice push, actually, for the 5, that horse that Cormac mentioned. All right, great stuff, Nick. We're going to close out the show with a little bit of racing history chat with Jennifer Kelly, picking up on our conversation from yesterday about basically the story of how the Kentucky Derby came to have parimutuel wagering. Pretty interesting stuff. Stick around for that if you're looking for a little extra content, and feel free to comment if you want on our YouTube channel, where we've got a ton of great stuff, including a show coming up with Nick Tamaro, which we're going to actually record right now. But so, Nick, you hang around for that, and we'll be talking soon.
Sounds great, my friend. Looking forward to it.
If you're looking for a cool contest to play in on Kentucky Derby Day, look no further than the Kentucky Derby Betting Challenge. You can play it from our friends over at First/ExpressBet. You also have the opportunity to win your way in through a whole bunch of feeders. The big contest, $3,000, $2,000 is a bankroll, $1,000 in prize pool, and the prizes are cool. BCBC seats, NHC seats, UBC seats, Pegasus seats, as well as cash. You can get all the information, expressbet.com/tournaments. But think about playing in this Kentucky Derby Challenge to make your Kentucky Derby day that much more exciting. expressbet.com/tournaments. Very pleased to welcome back to these airwaves my favorite racing historian. She's done amazing work in her books, The Foxes of Bel Air, Gallant Fox, Omaha, and The Quest for the Triple Crown, as well as Sir Barton and the Making of the Triple Crown. Lots of interest in her work, with this being Derby 150 and lots of Derby history to talk about. We're going to get into some of the more unsung Derby history in this appearance. But first, let's welcome back Jennifer Kelly.
Yay! Thanks, Pete. Always glad to be here.
So last show, we talked about Ben Ali and sort of the betting debacle, we'll call it, at the 1886 Kentucky Derby, and how that led to sort of some leaner times for the prominence of the Derby, with a little bit of a split between the Derby and prominent Eastern owners, et cetera, et cetera. But you teased the idea that there's a story behind how betting at the Derby changed and became parimutuel in nature, and then that was kind of it. I wanted to get the fuller version, or the real version, of that story on another show. Not sure where we're going to air this, but we'll pop it in there at some point, or we'll do it as a little standalone. So why don't we pick up the story with what was going on late 19th century, just with the betting side of the Kentucky Derby?
Okay, well, the late 19th century was mostly focused on bookmakers as your main way of, you know, putting down a wager. There were auction pools and even some limited parimutuel wagering, but for the most part, bettors were familiar with bookmakers, and bookmakers had come to the United States several decades before from England. And so that was what everyone knew, and to do something like parimutuel wagering was still a newer concept to people. And so it had not quite caught on when we get to this particular point in Derby history, which is, you know, we talked about James Ben Ali Hagen and his run-in with Meriwether Lewis Clark about the bookmakers or the absence of bookmakers. And now we're fast-forwarding to 1908, where you're in the middle of the Progressive Era. So if you're familiar with Teddy Roosevelt and that point in American history, there's a lot of Progressive Era movements to fix things like, you know, the meat industry, the medical industry, break up monopolies. And then there was also the somewhat terrible idea called Prohibition, which came out of the era. And then that was part of the Progressive Era. It wasn't necessarily something that Teddy Roosevelt himself worked on, but it was one of those movements in that era to eliminate vice in American society. So while we're going to eliminate all these vices within American business, like monopolies, we're also going to work on bettering America. And one of, you know, the way that they decided to do that was to target vice, including alcohol and gambling. So, you know, Prohibition didn't pass until, I think, Woodrow Wilson's administration, somewhere in there. But the anti-gambling movement started really early, like the late 19th century, the last decade or so, and then into the first part of the 20th century, where there were movements across the country to outlaw gambling, and most specifically bookmaking, because they felt like bookmakers were most apt to take advantage of people,
right?
And, you know, people who were not knowledgeable about gambling. And so, you know, if you're spending all your money gambling, then you're not spending your money on your family or, you know, putting back into the economy as a good worker, that kind of thing. And so,
So went the thought,
yes, of course. And just, and this is why you have no racing in California at this point in history, because racing had existed in California until Progressive Era movements, anti-gambling movements came in, and the state of California outlawed gambling. Until you get to the 1930s, and that's when you have Santa Anita and Del Mar open. And so this creeps across the country. It hits pretty much every jurisdiction. New York eventually shuts down because of the anti-gambling movement. But by 1908, it had come to Louisville, and the new mayor that was installed that year had led a movement in the city council to basically outlaw bookmakers in Louisville, which meant that the Derby was not going to be able to use bookmakers for wagering. So of course, Matt Wynn and company are anticipating this, and they start looking for ways to get around this. Auction pools are still a thing, right? But the other way to get around it is pari mutuel wagering, because that's more egalitarian.
In theory. And
in theory, yes. And fortunately, Matt Wynn found out that Meriwether Lewis Clark had been very forward-thinking in his planning when he was founding the Derby and Churchill Downs, and had the city council write in a law that said pari mutuel wagering was permitted, which, because he had planned to use pari mutuel machines at the Derby. And so Wynn finds this little, you know, thing that helps them out. He's like, okay, good. We can use pari mutuel wagering if we can't use bookmakers. Well, the problem is the city council is one step ahead of him, and they're like, no, you can't do any gambling at the Derby. Like, none. And Wynn and Charles Granger and a bunch of men who are involved with the Louisville Jockey Club go to a judge to seek an injunction that will permit them to use the pari mutuel machines.
Then and now, injunctions at the Kentucky Derby. Fascinating.
Right. And with the injunction in place, the judge ruled in their favor and said, yes, you can use pari mutuel machines. And so Matt Wynn goes, great, where are the machines? Because they don't actually know where they are. They know they exist, because, you know, I'm sure that Meriwether Lewis Clark at some point had told them that they were, you know, they existed, but they actually hadn't seen them for a couple of decades. And so Wynn and a bunch of people had to basically go through the racetrack and other places around Louisville in search of the machines.
That's amazing.
To be able to use them. They find them, but they're kind of in disrepair, so they have to very quickly find some people to make sure that they work to repair them. And then they are fortunate enough that to get a couple of machines from New York that were able to be shipped in really quickly. And by the time Derby Day 1908 rolled around, there were 6 pari-mutuel machines. Only 6.
How did that work out? I mean, was that sufficient? Do you have any idea on what they would have handled? Are there statistics on that type of thing?
I don't have them to hand. There might be somewhere. I know Matt Wynn has his biography that he wrote, or autobiography, his memoir. But I don't think he really goes into the numbers. I do know it was enough to keep them afloat.
Key point of the again then and now, the gambling was a huge part of the financial solvency of the of the institution, right.
And you know, the way the pari-mutuel machines worked, it wasn't a $2 bet, it was a $5 bet, so it did make it a bit more difficult for people to use, because you did have to lay down $5.
I mean, which is a lot of money back then, right? What do you think is the rough, yeah, again, I'm asking you things I didn't prep you for, but what would be the rough equivalent? I mean, it's got to be a lot.
Probably, I'm going to say upwards of $20, maybe. I'd have to do there's a calculator online, an inflation calculator that allow you to look at an estimation, but it's not an insignificant amount of money, but people are still willing to do it. They even sent out leaflets that showed you how to use the pari-mutuel machines, so that patrons, when they were coming into the racetrack that day, actually could look at these leaflets and then, you know, go up to the machines and understand what they were trying to do. And of course they had operators at all the machines to make sure that they were, you know, being done correctly, and that, you know, to help out anyone that had questions. So it turned the tide, because with this struggle against bookmakers because of the progressive era movement, it was like, okay, well, if we can't use bookmakers and it's going to become problematic legally over the long run, let's just go with pari-mutuel wagering and just stick with that, because that seemed more palatable in that era than
I've heard stories. This is terrible that I won't have the particulars. I was just told this story by Healy Bell when we were visiting, that there was I don't think he would have been a priest. He would have been a preacher, a religious man who was significant in helping turn the tide of like the idea that pari-mutuel wagering was more moral or something than gambling with bookmakers, who helped like turn the tide of public opinion to get this to happen, which obviously racing needed. I'd also love to hear more about that injunction and the judge who ruled and sort of what the specific legal logic was that made this type of gambling not okay and this type of gambling okay. Has there been any work done on that issue?
All I know is that Wynn and Granger basically scoured law books trying to find a loophole, and they were successful in finding the loophole that Clark had put in place when he opened the racetrack in 1875. So of course the city council and the mayor challenged this because they were anti-gambling. And the way that it was worded, when the judge looked at the law and then looked at what the anti-gambling movement was trying to do, he said, I'm going to have to rule in favor of these people because of the way that the law was worded.
Wow.
So whatever happened, you know, trying to challenge this, the anti-gambling movement was, you know, unsuccessful, at least at this point. Now, when you get to 1911 and New York racetracks closed, that was primarily because New York was using bookmakers. And, you know, they were trying, the Hart-Agnew laws passed, and they put more and more stipulations on how wagering should work, which became untenable for the racetracks, and essentially to the point where any sort of betting, whether it's just you and your friend exchanging money just between the two of you, was illegal. And so racetracks just shut down in protest of all these restrictions. And when they came back in 1913, after finally getting it all sorted, half the racetracks in New York just never reopened because of all this. And but they still didn't get a pari mutuel wagering until like the 30s.
That's another story for another time, but I really appreciate the information on the wagering history at the Kentucky Derby. I just think it's personally fascinating. Jennifer, really appreciate your time. Encourage folks to check out your fantastic work. What's the best way for people to find your books?
Well, I am all over Facebook, Twitter, TikTok. I try to do Instagram. I'm on Threads, so you can find me pretty much anywhere. I do have my website, which is jenniferkellywrites.com, and I do have a newsletter. So if anybody would like to subscribe to the newsletter, I would.
I need to do that. I don't have. I'm not a subscriber. So where do we find your? Where do we find that?
It's on the Jennifer Kelly Writes website. There's a sign up form right there, and I've been doing it once a month. I'm sending out a newsletter that has updates about the writing process for my third book, and then links to the work that I've done that month. And also just links to anything that I find personally fascinating. Some of it's racing related, some of it's just random stuff. But, you know, I just enjoy talking to people. And since I can't talk to every single person in person, here's a newsletter and here's a little bit of what I'm thinking about at that particular moment.
Jennifer, thank you so much for your time today. I just signed up for the newsletter myself. We encourage other folks to do same. And we'll have you back for something soon, whether it's trivia or more racing history.
Sounds great. I love it.
And that's going to do it for this extended edition of today's show. I want to thank all of today's guests, as well as our founding partners over at 10 Strike Racing. You know, around here, we always love to root for the purple and the black. Let's also thank our charity partner, Therapeutic Horses of Saratoga. This is where Kim Weir is plying her trade now, helping humans and helping horses. Learn more about their mission and give generously to their cause in themoneypodcast.com/horses. You're going to be hearing a lot more about Therapeutic Horses of Saratoga over the course of the next few months. Can't wait to get up there and check out the operation myself. Most of all, though, want to thank all of you for listening, making these shows so much fun to do, watching and subscribing to our YouTube content, subscribing to In the Money Plus, all the great stuff you do for us, but even just listening to these pods, that's plenty. We're happy with that. If you want to do more, you know what to do. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. I'm Peter Thomas Fornitow. May you win all your photos.